Welcome to the Victory Show.
What's up, Victors? Welcome to this week's Victory Show. If this is the first time you're joining us, I'm Travis Cody, best-selling author of 16 books, and I've had the privilege of helping hundreds of business consultants, founders, and entrepreneurs write and publish their own best-selling book. In my journey, I've discovered a fascinating pattern. A lot of businesses hit a revenue plateau, 500,000, a million, 5 employees to 10 employees, and they really struggle to break through that. So on this show, I sit down with some of the world's most successful CEOs, founders, leaders, and business owners to uncover the strategies that they use to overcome those plateaus and scale their businesses to new heights. So if you're looking to learn from the best and get actionable insights that can propel your business forward, you're in the right place. Today's show is going to be fantastic. My guest is a former Division I football player and professional athlete, Peter Ashton. He's carried the discipline, teamwork, and drive for excellence from the field into the business world. As a serial entrepreneur and investor, he's always been driven by the desire to push the boundaries of what's possible, particularly in the financial sector. His journey has spanned over 60 companies by the age of 30, where he has consistently sought out cutting-edge technologies to drive innovation and create lasting impact. Currently, Peter is the CEO of a revolutionary asset management firm that harnesses deep mathematical intelligence technology originally developed in 1996. I say 1996 because there's a fascinating story behind this technology we're going into. So you're not going to want to go anywhere. Stick around towards the later in this interview when we get into that, because it's going to blow your mind. Peter, thanks for being here today. I certainly appreciate you taking the time to join us.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
All right. So you had the awesome experience of being a Division I football player. And, yes. We're talking about this a little bit before the show. You started as a quarterback, but you ended as a free safety.
I did. Yeah. It was a,
you became your own nemesis.
I'm intercepting myself. Yes. No, I started off as a quarterback in high school and, at a small private school. And what was interesting about that is I had a mentor in when I was a junior, and he happened to be the backup quarterback to the Dallas Cowboys, John Kidna. Wow.
Yeah. Hey, that's a good mentor to have.
He mentored me for 2 years, and then his cousin played 4 years a wide receiver at Oregon State, and he knew the culture, he knew the coaches, and he called him up and said, hey, you need to look at this kid. And when I went up there and met the coaches, I knew that was the place for me. And I went there and played quarterback. It was the largest Division I offer for me for quarterback. And I probably should have stuck it out, but ended up switching positions. They ran a pro style offense. I was more of like a dual threat quarterback. And so I thought I could maneuver over into a pro style, but it wasn't for me. I needed to be active and run and do more, read options and stuff like that. Sure. So ended up playing strong safety for pretty much my whole career.
Wow. So what I love about that is the fact that, like, you can't get to Division I unless you've got discipline. So for you, obviously discipline at a young age was sort of inbred. When did you start playing football when you were like real little?
No, I was baseball. I was actually a better baseball player than I was at football.
Really?
I started baseball at a really young age, but football was like 7th to 8th grade.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Wow. So 4 years and then you chased the NFL. What was that journey like?
Just not what you think. it is very difficult. After a couple of years at Oregon State, I spent 1 year at North Texas, and then decided just to go pro. And so I knew I had the skills for it, and I had a lot of relationships in the sports world. And so I decided to go train. I trained at Onnit Academy. It was the Joe Rogan's gym. Wow. We were down there with trainer Joe DeFranco, who's like Brian Cushion's trainer, and Andrew Sandejo, and some guys that were playing in the NFL at the time. And I tried to give myself the best shot to play. And I had a really good agent who was a vice president of Select Sports Group down in Houston. And so I had it all. And, I tried to play for I think it was close to 9, 10 teams between the NFL, Canadian, and Arena Football, and it just didn't work out. I played one year with the Philadelphia Soul, which was an arena team up in Philly. Ron Jaworski owned the team, and it was a lot of fun. You're basically playing tackle football on a hockey rink.
Yeah, I was going to say it's a little faster pace.
It's a lot faster pace. And then that was it. I just kind of decided to stop after that.
So for a lot of athletes, especially when you have that dream and it's such a part of your life and I mean consuming your life, and then you get to the point where it's like it stops. Like that's a transition a lot of people struggle with. So how did you deal with that to getting to the point now of like, your whole life's about this one thing, and then it's sort of like, well, it's just gone as far as it's going to go. So, like, what did that pivot look like for you?
Yeah, it's a really hard thing because you spend, your entire life all day long, you're basically training and to be the best at a particular sport, and then when it doesn't pan out and you're done, there's no need to do it anymore. Like, there's no need to spend 8 hours a day, of your brain power thinking about it. And so I couldn't let it go and got into coaching. I coached 3 years of high school football,
Wow.
at my former school, and followed the offense coordinator when he took a head job somewhere else. And there was just, I couldn't, I was having a family. I had a growing family, and I had to support them. And so there's not much money in high school assistant coaching.
Shockingly.
And but if you play a bunch of years in the NFL and you go back into coaching like these guys are doing now, like that's a different,
Sure.
but then it was just hard. So I got into personal training. Again, I knew a lot about training, really
Yeah,
being
you've
the
been
best
training for a
physical.
decade at that point in time.
That's exactly right. And so I felt comfortable in that environment. And so I just kind of built up a private training practice to sustain my lifestyle. So.
Awesome. So we talked about something a little earlier when you were saying that there was a differentiator for you with your training businesses. Let's talk about that. What was the big lesson that you had when you started training?
Yeah, if you're a trainer, do not train the general population. You will have so much turnover, and the best client are the ultra wealthy, people who can pay for training consistently, and that are you actually learn a lot from them too. And so I pivoted from general population to I say general population, right? As kind of like in air quotes, we're all general population. But I started working with really the top 1% of America, and I grew that practice as a private practice, and I grew my book of business to close to 150 clients.
Wow. So you're now spending 10, 12 hours a day with guys who are phenomenally successful in a lot of areas of life. So how did you make use of that access to those people in that amount of time?
When you're training, very, very wealthy people, it's sometimes hard for them to warm up to you, but once they do and they feel like they trust you, it's the only 45 minutes of their life where they're being told what to do. So I got really good with communication with, people who have success. And so it doesn't matter to me if you have $1 billion or if you have $1, right? I'm gonna talk to you the exact same way. And so I learned that from these guys, but also learned a lot of different industries, how they made their money, how they view money, how they go about building an incredible team. I learned a lot about, having a board and what that's like. I learned about public companies. I had guys who were CEOs of very, very large public companies. I was basically their therapist almost. They would tell me things about their jobs and family and careers and you name it. And I got to learn a lot from these clients.
Was there any sort of like for you as a trainer, like anything shocking that you like when these guys would share like what life was actually like at that level that you were like, that is not what I thought it would be?
Yeah, a couple things. The first thing was they have no friends.
Wow.
The very because their friends usually they Their friends are around them because they have a lot of money and they're helping. But when something bad happens, all those people go away.
Yeah.
So I learned that they don't trust anybody. When usually when they do, they get taken advantage of. You've heard horror stories of things like that all the time. And then also they have a misconceived notion of doing good in the world while they're building their business. They don't think that is a good use of their company's resources. And that's why you have the separation of nonprofit and for-profit industries, because they once they build their business and make a bunch of money, then they go into, philanthropic work. They don't do it at the same time. And I learned that, which I thought was really interesting, of why couldn't you do good and build your business at the same time? But I would say, just those, they view money differently also, on how to grow their, they use it as a tool.
So I worked in Hollywood for 15, 16 years, and it was very much the same there, right? The more successful you became, the more friends would want to try to come into your circle, and that's the same thing. One flop movie, or even like some weird scandal that is usually not even true, but the press is presenting it as true for three, and then like everybody just, it's like cockroaches. The lights come on, they're like, I'm out of here. So I could see how that would be when you get up into certain echelons, because that's interesting. So how then did you go from being a trainer into doing what you do now and working in like asset management? Like what was the journey that, or again, the pivot, right? You had football and pivoted into training. So what was the pivot point from training into something else?
I felt like some of my clients needed to talk to my other clients because they were either in the same industry or I just felt like they could help each other and whatnot. And I was just trying to do what I thought was the right thing of connecting them. So I started connecting all my clients together to just do business. And what I realized was they would do business together. And I said that there's a whole industry like this. You could just make connections and get paid. And I thought that was awesome. And that's when I was like, oh, I'm gonna go into, I'm gonna do this full time.
In Hollywood, that's called being a producer. And just finding the best people and putting them together. So, what was the first deal that you did then?
We first deal was, believe it or not, in stem cell therapy.
Really?
So one of my clients was a very big stem cell manufacturer and distributor, and built an amazing company doing it. And he, some of his clients were, he worked with Mel Gibson's father.
Oh, wow.
If you, he basically
Mel
saved Mel
just talked
Gibson's
about
father.
him like a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah. So anytime his father, Mel Gibson's father, or he talks about his father in stem cell therapy, that was my client, the guy who administered that through his company. And so what we would do is we would, my dad had 20, I think it's like something like 20 something back operations. He was in a car accident, so his
Wow.
back is really bad. So there's this form of therapy called hydrokinetic spinal decompression, and it's doing underwater traction therapy to eliminate the need for neck, back, and spine surgeries. And we were going to do that therapy because my background was in training. And so I was going to administer all those therapies by a doctor's name, Dr. Leroy Perry. His business partner was Kareem Abdul-Jabbar out in California. So they had an aquatic center that they would do. They had worked with 20,000 patients, and he no longer does that anymore. But basically, we were going to do the underwater traction therapy, and then right after that, we pull them out, put them on a table, and inject stem cell therapy in between the vertebrae to help with,
Sure,
the
recoveries.
healing process, the recovery, so that they don't have to have back operations. Now, that obviously didn't work because, I'm not doing that anymore. But the idea behind it was, and I left my entire training business to go do that, and that didn't work out. And I was kind of left on the street again to figure it out. And that's when I got into real estate.
So the pivot then was you started becoming a real estate investor or like developer or just again putting
No.
your clients
Yeah.
together. Some were in
Yeah, I
real
worked
estate,
for
some
a
had money, and you put them together to invest deals.
Pretty much. I worked for a real estate REIT and real estate company in Dallas, and my job was to go find investors for the real estate projects and reached out to all my former clients and raised about 750,000. I think it was close to 850,000 actually in like 3 months when I was there. And it was like, this is awesome. This is great. And the guy that put in the 750,000 out of the 850,000 was my soon-to-be business partner. He's Japanese, and it was a very interesting. I knew his son in high school. I played football with his son in high school, so I called him and we started chatting. And then he connected me to his dad, and I met his dad and their his big company conference room, and it was great. So.
So what was his company? What was he doing at that point in time?
Yeah, he built a company called Funimation. So his the largest Japanese anime, it's like Netflix for Japanese anime, and his family, he basically bought the license from his family in Japan to bring over Dragon Ball Z to America, and built it. He sold his company the first time, bought it back, sold it again, and ended up selling the company to Sony Pictures. And so his company now accounts for tw almost 20% of Sony's current revenue.
Wow,
His
so
company. Yeah.
not too shabby. So he became your business partner. How did that work? So eventually he was an investor, like he invested in this project. So how did you guys then become business partners?
Yeah, he it's really all about timing. I approached him 2 weeks before his final payment from Sony, and he was going into retirement. He had to stay on for 2 years, run the business, and then he left 2 weeks before he left. That was when I approached him.
Oh, wow.
But
Yeah,
some of
that
my
is good timing.
some of my other clients, they had companies that they had started and new companies. They left their big firm, whatever they were at, and they're raising money. And so I asked him if he would help me review these companies so that I could go raise money for him. And I was at his house and we were sitting down, we were talking, and he's like, I want to invest in a lot of these companies. Let's start a venture capital firm and I'll invest into these companies that you bring me. And so my job was to do all the work, and he taught me everything. He was by far the best mentor I've ever had of just identifying how to invest in companies, how to, look at how to look at bad companies, how to, everything you could possibly imagine around money and investing and valuations and reading a spreadsheet and all that stuff he taught me.
Wow. All right, so we'll get into that second, but off the top of your head, what's the top three greatest lessons you learned from him during that period in time?
The top three lessons is always push against everybody's time frame. If anybody gives you a time frame, push up against hard again and always go past it. So time frames are irrelevant.
So if somebody says, I need a month for this, you're like, I'll give you a week.
No, if someone says, we're trying to raise this round, we're trying to build this business, these are our dates and time frames, I always push past them. So I never go off of at someone's time frame. If they're like, hey, let's reach out in a week, or we were trying to raise this round by this date, or I need this investment by this date, I never do that. And the reason why is because the people will say the deal terms will change if we don't have it by this date. They use time to try to get better terms for their business, or they try to use time to they leverage time for their advantage. When the reality is the person who has the money, time is irrelevant. You can take as much time in the world, and if the deal passes, and it actually does happen where you miss out, there's always another deal around the corner. So never, never go off of anybody's
That's
time frame.
interesting. People who are trying to raise money try to create FOMO, even though like that's like completely not a thing for investors, where they're like, yeah, there's another one right down right around the corner.
Not sophisticated investors. If you're a real, most VC firms are just gamblers, really. They take a gamble at they don't really know if the company is going to be successful, so there's really no difference, in my opinion. But the second lesson is keep your circle really, really tight. of trusted people. And the third thing is, I learned is you can actually build a business and do good in the world and help people at the same time. You don't have to have it separate.
Yeah, that's it. That was probably pretty eye opening once you got to that level after all those years of people saying, no, they got to be separate.
Mm-hmm.
So what I love about this, right, is this show is all about like, how do we get to the point where we scale? And usually we're talking to people who have built a company, scaled it out and exited, but you're coming now from the opposite side of what everybody wants. Every business is like, I'm looking for investors. That's the unicorn, right? I need, everybody wants more money. So you're coming in and now you're seeing the other side of it, of being able to analyze like what makes a good company, what makes it ripe to be able to scale, you know, what makes it right, ripe for a, and then at the same time, like something that looks really amazing on paper, you're seeing the things of like, no, that's something we'd never invest in. So let's talk about that. So from an investment standpoint, what are kind of the main criteria that would attract you as an investor of going like, this is a really good investment versus not a good investment? And I'll just kind of point of reference, like we had somebody on the show a couple of weeks ago where he was talking about how there was one company looked really amazing on paper and had crazy, crazy revenue. And then there was another company that was making like 1/10 the revenue. But then when you got into the financials of it, the one over here was a way better investment because it was run more tight and had less debt and had whatever. And this one actually, even though on paper it was this big monster, was like behind the scenes is like, that was not a great investment. So they ended up picking up the small one instead. So I'm just, That may be a poor example. That's just an example I remember from weeks ago. So
it's a good example because what people don't realize is at least now, right? So I'm going to talk about it from like today's, not like, you know, a couple of years ago, because it's a different landscape. The things that are happening today are not really going to apply to where I was, you know, in 2019, sure. 2021.
Yeah.
So the time of valuation arbitrage is done. So what I mean by that is, there in 2019, really 2018, 19, 20, 21, investors play the valuation arbitrage. I'm going to get in at this valuation and exit at this valuation.
Yep.
And then they're going to do that at scale with as many companies as possible. And they're going to play the odds, right? Really, it's gambling.
Yep.
Because it didn't matter. This is when going back, this is when SPACs were huge and it didn't matter about revenue. It didn't matter about, you know, it just mattered about valuation, right? I'm going to keep increasing, right, the valuation until I get bought. And that was a game. So that does not apply anymore today. There are there's over 30 now. If you start a business, 33% of businesses today are doing it bootstrapped. They're not actually out looking for money.
Yep.
So that it is increasing and they don't need a co-founder anymore. They're kind of individual people that are starting a business, utilizing technology to help them build their business. So from an investor standpoint, it is going to be a lot harder to be profitable in your venture capital firm, your family office, your venture side going forward, because you have to really identify what's going to be a good investment. And most of the time, the people running the venture capital firms, they're not operators. They're good at raising money and building a business. Before you had to be good at raising money, right? Now you have to be a good operator. And so it's changing the landscape a little bit.
So how much has that percentage changed over then, say, the last decade, where you're saying that like right now, 33% are bootstrap businesses? What did that used to be historically?
It used to be sub 10.
Wow.
I mean, most people, when they start a business, they had to have money because they had to build technology.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, 10 years ago, there were far less investment firms. So if you needed money, you go to a few places. That's why you have some of the biggest venture capital firms in the world. They manage billions of dollars. If I'm an investor, you can't even invest into them without having a certain minimum, like 10, 20, $30 million. right? Well, today from 2008, 2009, there's like 30, 40, 50, there's like close to probably 100,000 new investment firms that have popped up, whether it's
A
through registered
hundred
investment.
thousand.
It's globally, it's crazy. So like I have a database of 50,000 investors, and you know, it's at this point, I personally believe the investment landscape is very saturated. So like, you know, if I'm an investor and I'm trying to deploy money, right, it doesn't matter what fund I go into, because I could go pick 10 of the exact same funds to invest in. So what makes one fund different than another fund, right?
That's
You as the
unreal.
investor have to identify what that is. Otherwise, there's no difference. You just take your pick and you're gambling again at that point. You're like, I have to deploy this money because I don't want it sitting in a bank account, right? That's the conceived notion that everybody has, is I don't want money sitting in a bank account earning no interest, so I have to deploy it into a wide variety of different assets. Okay. Well, the age of invest, it's the dynamic is changing dramatically.
Yeah.
Okay. It's moving away from investing in early stage companies and getting these big 10, 20, 30, 50 times exits. It's getting into investing in things that give you cash flow, right? More people are wanting cash flow, wealth preservation, rather than these huge, you know, because that's where the valuations would. The reason why you have those big exits is because you have that major valuation of going from here to here in a very short amount of time. Well, because if that's going away, then what are you left with? You're left with, you can't go into early stage investing because there's less companies that are needing money because they're just utilizing technology to build their business, and they don't need, you know, there's 6,000, 7,000 AI tools right now for you to build your business.
Sure.
You don't need money anymore at that
Yeah, I
point.
just was watching some kid. I say he's a kid. He's in his late 20s, and he was talking about how AI was going to allow for the first single solopreneur billion-dollar company. And just by leveraging the tools of like how much things you can now consolidate just through tech. So, so you work then with your business partner. You went through 60 companies that you actually invested in or helped manage, and which is a phenomenal amount of companies in a very short period of time. And now you've pivoted from that again, and now you are running your own asset management firm. And so now that you're doing that, like, how is your philosophy different with your firm than from pretty much, because I mean your background here is phenomenal. And I mean, you learned it, you know, right at the side of somebody who's obviously a business genius. So you have this context that so few people in the world have now. How has that influenced where you're at now and the vision you have for the company that you have moving forward?
Yeah, so I've been either as a direct investor, or I've raised money, or I've been a part of a total of over 60 companies.
Yeah.
So I've seen a lot of things. There's a lot of things that work. Either from I've started companies and they failed. I've failed miserably. I've failed on a business and lost everything. I mean, I lost my house, everything, zero. So I've gone to the ups and downs. Like, I know, you know, from that. But the interesting part about where I'm at today and what I'm doing is I'm not trying to invest into any companies. I'm not trying to deploy money into a company anymore to grow a business. That'll come in the future, but I think it's going to be what I call, and how I was on my, I've got my own podcast, and I was talking with Paul Allen, who started Ancestry.com, and we were talking about you know, the there's going to become a day and age where crowdfunding is in its infancy stage. So if you can open source crowdfunding and allow it for you start a business and then open up a $5 million amount, and you have people globally that can pour money in instead of having it only access to accredited investors, qualified clients, and so forth, that's where the world's going to move into. And so what we're doing now is building technologies on top of technologies to solve the liquidity problem for investors. So it's a little bit different, in investing. We're investing in things that are extremely liquid, but generate very, very high returns.
Right. And so let's talk about a little bit, because I don't think so for people who are not investors, I don't think they understand, why that's such a big deal. Right. Because in traditionally, hasn't it been if you put money into a company, sometimes, it may be years before you can get it out. Or even if you have money in a company and it's been there for years and you're like, hey, something happened, my situation changed, I need my money back. It's not liquid. It can take 6-12 months sometimes to get pull money back out. Correct.
Correct.
And
yeah,
so,
it's a pain.
And so you're using technology now to solve that problem where you have the liquidity plus the returns as well.
Yeah, it's really, honestly, it's not so much about the returns. It's more of, the returns are there over a period of time.
Sure.
But it's more of having access to your money, right? Mm. And, if you do it correctly, you're going to generate returns, right? It's just how the market works.
So how are you harnessing now the software you're using, which you refer to as a deep mathematical intelligence technology? So your mm-hmm. business partner, he built that, was one of the coders for that back in 1996. Is that correct?
He wasn't one of the coders, but he was one. He's a very technical trader. His name is Richard Lackey, and he is a, 6-time hedge fund manager. But what he did was he was very fascinated with patterns. And so he went and a couple of his friends that worked for NASA and the government, basically they modified technology that used for intercepting incoming missiles. So if your missile's launched at a target, right, there's a lot of math that goes into identifying where that missile is going to intercept it, right? Because if you miss, people die. So it has to be.
So this
accurate.
Is the technology that's basically powering Israel's Iron Dome.
Yeah, it's not that technology. A version of it,
yeah.
Right? A scaled down version. But yeah, it essentially looks at a symbol, right? It could be a stock symbol, currency, you name it. And it goes back to the history of when it was, there's price action, when the price action first started. And it looks at every single data point and all the patterns, and it breaks it down into 7 time frames. So it looks at it from like a 5-minute time frame of going back every 5 minutes. Wow. And then figuring out patterns inside those 5 minutes. And, 5 minutes, 30, 15, 15 minutes, 30 hour, daily, weekly. And what it will do is then it will go into a mathematical formula to project out new patterns based off of past patterns. Wow. So it's saying, because this happened here, it then finds patterns that match each other and then predicts out in advance, 40 to 50 time frames out in the future. And we trade off of that. We don't trade off of what's happening, what we think, what our economist is saying. We trade off of real data patterns.
So you're essentially skating to the puck, as the analogy goes.
Yes. And but it's very complicated. It's very, it's dynamic. So it moves, and we use what's called pressure in the market, which not many people understand or even use. We use velocity, momentum. So in real time, it's projecting a certain price. That price could change in a matter of seconds, and you have to watch it. And so our tech monitors that and automatically moves money based off of where we're projecting it to move and what the market is doing at the same time.
Wow. And that's, yeah. So it's amazing. Like, I would say a layman like myself, who's not done a lot of investing, you hear about that technology, and the assumption to me has always been like, oh yeah, well, that's something that, like, Chase Bank with $2 trillion in assets under management, that's what they use. And now you're saying like that technology is available to, normal people, although obviously this guy has been involved at this for what, we're 35 years now, almost. Yeah. 30 years. That's crazy.
Yeah. It's crazy. So when you look at like disruptive tech, right, you have to look at green flags and red flags. Green flags are like, let's start with a red flag. Red flag is if I built a technology, right, and it's new, or it's, even if it's old or whatnot, and I'm out trying to get as many people into it as possible, I'm going to have red flags, because if it's so great, why aren't you using it, yourself?
Mm.
Right. So Richard, he kept it private. his entire time. He built it, never told anybody. And
Smart.
he built his own web. Also used that to in 2015, where he stopped trading, took all of his assets and put it into what's now the World Food Bank. He's the chairman and founder of the World Food Bank, utilizing his technology to lift close to 1.5 million people out of poverty every year in Africa. That's his journey. So
Wow.
his tech allowed him
Built
to go
that.
do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now that is powering what you guys are doing.
Now it's powering what we do, and we're doing it in two forms. We're doing it as a fund model, where we allow investors to gain access to our automated trading platform, utilizing our trade management system and our indicators that's been around since 1996. But we also do it in a an app version. We're building an app that the general population can download. They can pay $49 a month or $99 a month, and they can have access to it to trade $100, $500, 2,000, 5,000, 10,000. And because we're not managing their money, it actually auto trades for them based off their parameters that they put in. So they
Wow.
can download it, they can throw in $500, they can click Tesla and click start, and it will auto trade Tesla for them. They don't have to worry about it.
That
Yeah.
app out now, or is it still in development?
It's almost done.
Was it,
Yeah, it's
do you
almost
have the
done.
name for it yet? Because by the time this comes out, maybe it'll be live.
It's called the Flow app.
The
So our
Flow
tech,
app.
it's called Flow. It's called Flow.
Yeah.
And so
I love it.
it'll
It's
be,
meditation with money. This is perfect. The Flow app.
yeah, that's exactly right.
So, I mean, you're a young guy. You've had a lot of success. Where for the over this next decade, by when where do you see yourself and your company by the time you're 40? Or
Yeah,
where would you like
so
to be, I should say? Like,
yeah, I actually want to go coach football.
go full circle.
That's a good way. I'm starting this next year coaching, but what I want to do is utilize and kind of open source this investment world of like giving everybody the tools to make money, like the ultra wealthy, right? And so the government and SEC and FINRA and all these, there's all these rules and regulations around investing. But if you allow for the general population, people who only have $500, to gain access to amazing technologies, right, to build their business, and you also give the ultra wealthy, right? I've got five different trading algorithms that I have access to and we use and generate. They can generate between 60 and 125, 150% a year. And you do that by, and it's all liquid every single month, every
Wow.
single day.
Wow.
So I don't have to invest into companies anymore. I can invest it into these systems, but I can get into this, longer term of where I think the investment world is moving to, where it's not going to be public, it's all going to be private. There's going to be no public companies. And
You think
that's for
we're heading that way?
just recently, I don't know if you saw, but Revolut, the founder sold like 400 million on the secondary market. So there was no need to IPO. So the secondary market is exploding right now. And so the reason why people go public is because they make a ton of money. Well, if you can make a ton of money on the secondary market, there's no need to go public. So you're
Yeah.
going to start seeing a shortage of companies that are going to go public. And so,
What a remarkable journey that
yeah.
this is becoming. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is fantastic. So if so I you said you had a podcast. If people want to find you and follow you, because this is fascinating information. I mean, this is life-changing information, I think, for most people. How do people find you? How do they follow you? How do they get involved? What you got going on?
Yeah, I do have a LinkedIn. You can find me there. But I've been wanting to do a podcast for a long time because I have a lot of interesting people that I can talk to about how they built their business, and so decided to do it. Launched it just re recently. I've got three episodes. It's called Ex the Expand X Podcast. We're trying to expand people's knowledge, their finances, their careers. If someone is looking to build a business, we will literally help them build their business. We'll give them all the tools they need. We'll help them get connected to the right leadership. To really, there's a lot of ways to build a business, and People think that their knowledge of how they build their business is proprietary, and that's just not true. It's just being selfish. So we're really trying to help people kind of build their business. But the goal with it is to make the world a better place to work. And that's
So is that
why
the Expand X is the podcast and also the platform for that, or just everything's in the podcast?
everything's in the podcast. Yeah, you can reach out to me directly, emails. I've got a text platform. You can just text me, and yeah, it's pretty
Fairly
easy to
approachable
get
for
it.
a asset management guy.
Yeah, again, I'm not executing trades. We have an automated system that does it. So, I don't have to, the day and age of actual and individual manage people's money is over. And so,
Man, that's fantastic.
frees up my time
Yeah.
to have meaningful conversations with
What
people.
a
So,
time to be alive, and what a time to be an investor, right? I should say,
yeah, exactly.
general population investor.
Yes, exactly right.
Peter, thanks so much for your time. This has been fantastic. I really appreciate it.
You got it.
Right,
Thank
take
you.
care.